Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, subscribe to us through iTunes, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Show tonight, a great one in store for you this evening. A little bit later on the show, we'll be talking about a movie called What Maisie Knew, with that film's director Scott McGeehy and David Siegel, and we'll also have some great movie talk and a mystery movie score to close out the show. I'll give you guys a hint. It is probably the world's most revered film composer doing the sequel to the world's most revered horror film. Okay.
Oh my God! I think I know what it is.
So that'll be at the very end of the show. That's just something I'll throw out to give our listeners something to chew on and contemplate. In the meantime, let's get to our first guest at the top of the show. Though our first two guests, actually, there's a new film out. It's called Drinking Buddies. It's from writer-director Joe Swanberg. Mr. Swanberg has been on our show prior to talk about his segment of the horror anthology series VHS, and he's back tonight to talk about this one, and he's joined by Ron Livingston, a great actor who we all love from Office Space, and also The Conjuring. I mean, this is a big year for him because I really liked him in The Conjuring, and I like the conception of that husband character in The Conjuring. Because it's not the usual character that just sits there forever and says, no, you're just seeing things, you're going crazy, there has to be a reasonable explanation. It was so refreshing to see that character done differently in that type of film.
He's also in another movie this year by Lynn Shelton, who did a film called Touchy Feely.
Yeah, I want to see that. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, that's become one of my favorite films so far this year. So and great, he's part of a really great coterie of actors, including Rosemary DeWitt and Ellen Page. And
yeah, he's married to Rosemary DeWitt. He's going to be a recurring character on the upcoming season of Boardwalk Empire as well. So it's a great year for him.
No, it is.
So we had Tony Farinella handled both of these interviews for us and did a terrific job. Probably the best interviews that he's done for us so far, and we appreciate that very much, Tony. Here they are. First, you'll hear from Ron Livingston, to be followed by Joe Swanberg. Also, an interesting note, Joe Swanberg is also an actor, and he's one of the actors in Your Next, the highly anticipated horror film out next week.
That is that's a huge movie.
So many multi-hyphenates in the show.
There are. I mean,
so Drinking Buddies is now available on a variety of online platforms, including iTunes and Amazon, and also available on demand. And here is Ron and Joe to tell us all about it.
When it comes to weddings, you want something that you know most people are going to like. Gets everyone sufficiently drunk. No fights between the families. Can I see the ring?
Oh, my God.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's great. What'd you do wrong?
Stop working so hard. I don't want you guys to strain yourself.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Kate.
Some great salad.
Disgusting. I'm trying not to get scurvy.
Come on,
not my beer.
Oh, that's an expert beer tasting technique.
Really?
Oh,
oh no! You're gonna get me fired! Chris is here.
Oh, I can't wait to meet him.
If I introduce you, don't say anything stupid or mean.
Hi,
everybody!
Pleasure, yeah.
Heard a lot of great things about you, and we're excited to have you.
Really?
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys filmed in Chicago, and I read you spent a lot of time in Chicago early on in your career. What did that mean to you, and what was it like to film in Chicago again and be there?
It was great. It's funny. You know, I grew up in Iowa. I spent probably three and a half years in Chicago in the early 90s, and I've lived in L.A. for 20 years since then. But I still think of myself as a Chicago guy. It's funny how that works. So it was a little strange going back and really realizing how much I really don't know Chicago. The whole what's going on in the West Side, you know, it's and how sort of hip it's gotten. None of that was there, you know, in 92, 91 when I was last there. So It's really amazing to see the transformation of it. But there's a part of my heart that's always going to be in Chicago.
How did Chicago help shape you as an actor?
You know, when I was kind of coming out of school, I remember seeing a video of. You know, the Malkovich, Sinise, True West. And it really kind of shaped, you know, to me, I'd been to New York and seen stuff on Broadway, but what those guys were doing, it was like how raw it was and visceral and close to the audience. I was like, this is where it's at, you know. That's the kind of stuff that I would like to get involved with. And it was a big part of why I moved to Chicago. Now, the odd thing, you know, the funny thing is when you get there, Malkovich and Sinise aren't there anymore. They've left for L.A. But, you know, there were a lot of kids, I think, that flooded into Chicago at the same time for the same reasons. And so it was a really exciting place to be, you know, cutting your teeth and doing theater I think there was a shared sensibility of people trying to do something that was trying to recreate that, which I don't think you can ever really do, but it's valiant to try.
And you mentioned those experiences, and with a film like Drinking Buddies, how did those experiences kind of help you on a film like this, where there's no script and it's kind of fly by the seat of your pants?
You know, at this point, the Chicago stuff was 20 years ago, so it didn't creep into it in that same way. I wasn't a guy who had ever done, you know, Second City or Improv Olympic comedy style improv, but I had a lot of friends who did. I spent a lot of time going to those shows to watch roommates and friends and, you know, people that I'd worked with kind of cut their teeth and you know, do that stuff. But this was an entirely different animal, I think. It's, you know, I wouldn't compare it to the same thing. It's a little bit like, well, I don't know what it's like. I was going to say writing as you go, but it's not, because I think in writing you're trying it out and listening to it in your head. And this, you just kind of have to open your mouth and trust what comes out. And then you really have to pay attention to what comes out of the other person's mouth and wait to hear what that is before you go on.
Mm-hmm. And the thing I really enjoyed about this film, Ron, was the chemistry with the cast. Because when you see a film, you can tell when that chemistry is real and when it's artificial. How was that sort of created to where it had that authentic and organic feel for everybody?
I don't think you can create it. You know, people talk about chemistry a lot. And there's always like a magic, they talk about it like there's a magic formula to it. I think really what it just comes down to is people paying attention to each other, you know. You really have to just pay attention to the other person and you know, find the things that you like and find the things that you don't like and that piss you off, and just like let that happen. And if both people are doing that, then all of a sudden the scene comes alive, you know, and you call it chemistry.
Mm-hmm. And this is a great time in your career right now with this film Drinking Buddies and Conjuring. I wanted to ask you, what do the good films have in common? What is one, I guess, singular thing that you look at that makes a film work for audiences and for actors?
You know, it's going to sound really stupid, but it tried to be good. You can't, it's really hard to make a good film. It's much easier to make a bad film than it is to make a good film. It's an equal amount of work, but you can't really make a good film without deciding to, without saying we're gonna try to make this good. And I think so. That's really where I start. Is, are these people gonna try to make a good movie, or are they happy to just make a movie? Joe, I could tell was aiming high. You know, I mean, I've answered this question actually as relates to The Conjuring, which had a great run. I think it's still doing well, and it's a little bit the same thing where, you know, you could just tell sometimes when you talk to the director and you look at the things that they've done, you see the actors are going after, you look at the shape the script is in. You know, this one didn't have a script, but just Joe talking about the ideas, it comes through, you go, oh, this guy's a filmmaker, you know, and he wants to make a great film. And if you do that, that's the kind of thing that I want to get on board with, because then whether we succeed or not, it's fun, you know, like at least we're going to try. And if we fail, we'll learn something, but you'll never succeed or learn something unless you decide that, like, we're gonna really try to make this movie great.
And then from the other end, Ron, how does a film that tries to be good, how does a good film end up bad in your opinion?
How does it end up bad? There's a million different ways it can end up bad. It's just a million different ways. It's a collaborative medium. It takes, you know, it takes so many people to make a movie, and it's a brittle process where if you have just a couple of people who drop the ball or don't know what they're doing or aren't on the same page or this wasn't communicated, and it sort of falls apart. It's almost like magic when it happens. To be honest, I don't ever know how it works. It's kind of always a miracle when a movie comes together, and you sit in the theater and you watch it, and the audience is, you know, and it just works, and the audience connects to it. At that moment, it's a little bit like magic, because you're looking at, you know, 2 years worth of painstaking work by 150 different people that all comes together in like a single moment. It's just the greatest. It's the greatest feeling in the world when it works, and you get hooked on it. And you know, I've kind of spent a whole life chasing that feeling. And I hope to spend the rest of my life chasing it as well.
In terms of that feeling, when you're on a film like Drinking Buddies, and there's no script, do you get a sense of when you're on set, like, hey, this is something special, or do you kind of have to wait to see some of the film? When do you sort of click that, hey, a film like this is working?
I've never been able to know. I feel like you can tell sometimes, you definitely can tell when a film is not working, and that's a terrible feeling, to be on a film and feel like, oh, boy, you know, like this just isn't coming together. But I've never been able to tell that a film is going to, until you're sitting in the audience and you see it roll. And then I feel like in the first 5 or 10 minutes, you know, of the projector rolling, you go, oh, I, holy crap, we got something here, you know? But you just, the editor is so, you know, the editor is so important. The sound design is important. The score is important. You know, the cinematography is important. And as an actor, you can sort of see where the camera is, but you don't always see the shot they have. You know, so I never really know. You know, you have to trust. You have to trust that the other people are as committed to doing their job as well as you are committed to doing your job as well. And you have to let, you know, you got to leave them alone and let them do that and let them succeed or fail as they're gonna.
And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you one office space question.
Sure.
What is your perspective on the film now that you've had time to kind of look back on it and process all the impact? What's your thoughts on the film now, today, and your perspective on it?
I think it still holds up. You know, I'm extraordinarily proud of it. You know, like I say, it's rare that you get a movie that works the way that Office Space does. And I feel like I've been fortunate enough to get to be in a couple of them, you know? Yeah, I think it's a movie that people can really relate to. I think because in, you know, you get underneath the workplace thing, and it's a little bit about people kind of adrift trying to figure out what their life is about. And I think there's something about that that's universal. And so there's something really comforting about watching a movie where you see people in the same existential boat, you know, and that is also just really entertaining, you know. So I'm extremely proud to have been a part of it.
Hello, Peter. What's happening? I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. So if you could be here around 9, that would be great. Okay? Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too. Okay? We lost some people this week, and we need to sort of play catch-up. Thanks.
And Ron, I've heard a lot of actors talk about even when they're established and they have work coming in, they still have that fear of where is the next job coming from or is the next job going to come in. Do you still live with that fear sometimes?
Not really, no. You know, the truth of the matter is that no matter who you are, there's a day that comes that you can't work anymore. And for some people, it's the day they croak. And for some people, it comes earlier than that. So you know that day's coming. But I feel like how do I put this? I've had enough years. You get older and you approach the career for some different reasons. I think when you're young, you want to set the world on fire and you have something to prove. At this point, you've either proved it or you realize, well, I'm not going to be able to prove whatever it is. So I got to just let that go and try to make it about something else. You know, what I'm really enjoying right now is just trying to tell stories in a way that connect with people. You know, I've kind of fallen in love with the idea that we're all in this together and we're in the same boat, and that movies are a way of making people realize that and feel that. So I'm digging on that. And that one, the nice thing about that is you don't actually even have to be in the movie. You can just go see one that's really good and enjoy that. So you know, I feel lucky to be a part of any gig that'll have me. I hope it continues.
I just have one more quick question for you, Ryan.
Yeah.
And you mentioned starting out and that, I guess, wanting to set the world on fire. When you're working with these actors in Drinking Buddies, Chase Johnson, Anna Kendrick, and Olivia Wilde, what do you pick up on them? Because they're kind of in, I guess, a different stage of their career than you are. What kind of energy do you pick up from them?
It's so exciting. It's so exciting to see these guys just really hitting their stride and coming into their own. Anne is an Oscar nominee, so I think the secret had been out on her. But I think this movie really shows a side to Olivia and Jake that I'm not sure audiences had gotten to see before. There's just a real, depth and quality to both of their performances. It's just really awe-inspiring, you know. I try to learn from it. I try to steal from it, and I mostly just really enjoy the front row seat of seeing it. I expect just great things to come out of all three of those people.
But definitely. Thank you so much for your time, Ron. It was really good talking to you. I'm actually from Hickory Hills, Illinois myself, so I'm in Illinois right now, actually.
Go Bears! Go Bears!
I'm actually a Packer fan, believe it or not.
Oh, damn it. Curse you.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the different challenges from directing VHS to something like Drinking Buddies. What do they both do for you creatively, and what do they both kind of challenge you with creatively?
It's interesting because I do feel that horror films and comedy films sort of rely on the same kind of timing in terms of, of the editing and you know, the build-up to a joke or, you know, the build-up to a scare and then the moment of release afterward. You know, you sort of the two genres have quite a bit of overlap. But, you know, with VHS it was fun because we knew that we only had to do about 15 minutes, you know, so you get a little more experimental. For instance, choosing to have the whole thing take place within Skype windows is not something that I would choose to do for a feature film, you know, but for a short segment seemed right. So on a technical level, it was different. And also with VHS, there was a lot more choreography involved. You know, we sort of knew that we were going to be doing these long takes, and because there weren't traditional cuts, because we were sort of within the Skype window, we had to really block it out and shoot those sequences in a very sort of deliberate manner. With Drinking Buddies, it's more, you know, it's sort of much more in line with the other films that I've made, and there's a freer, looser sort of feeling to the performances and to the way that it's shot. But you know, they're I love doing them both. I actually hope to do more horror stuff. And then challenge wise, I placed a lot of pressure on myself with Drinking Buddies that I didn't have with VHS because Drinking Buddies was going to be so much bigger than anything I had done before, you know. So I wanted to rise to the occasion and make a film that you know connected with a bigger audience but that also maintained the kind of intimacy and spontaneity and you know realness of the other movies that I had made. So every day on set, I sort of had to figure that out and navigate that, you know, my instincts to, like, go small and naturalistic versus a desire to open the movie up and sort of have it feel bigger and more comprehensive than anything I had done. But, it was great. It was a nice challenge to have.
When I talked to you last time, Joe, you were telling me about how you've always been fascinated by relationships and how they work with communication. With this film, Drinking Buddies, what are you discovering about relationships that you're using in your films now and evolving with?
Well, you know, the big question that we asked ourselves with Drinking Buddies was, can men and women be friends? And especially, can a man and a woman who are attracted to each other be friends? We tried to explore that, you know, this sort of the ins and outs of that topic. I think some personal feelings that I have that I put into the movie are that it's entirely possible for men and women to be friends, and I actually think that they can be great friends. But I do think that the whatever the sort of attraction and sort of sexual nature of the relationship is, it needs to be addressed. You know, I think that it's hard for men and women to be friends if they don't acknowledge the attraction in one way or another. But if they can get over it, then I think that those can be great friendships. You know. You know, the other thing that hopefully the movie deals with that I think is interesting is that it's not always the best situation to be in a relationship with somebody who's exactly like you. It's nice to have balance in relationships, you know, and so people who seem like an obvious fit with each other aren't necessarily going to have the healthiest relationship, even though it maybe seems more fun or more obvious. So we tried to explore that too, to really get into the idea of sort of taking these four different characters who all were at different points in their lives and had different kinds of things going on, and playing around with the attractions between all of them and the different scenarios, and sort of seeing which ones made the most sense.
And what I'm finding very fascinating right now, Joe, is films like yours, films like The Spectacular Now, films like The Way, Way Back. It seems like these films are really catching the attention of the audience this summer. And we've seen a lot of big blockbusters that are flopping and not doing so well. Do you think that audiences are looking for something more, something to, I guess, laugh, entertain, and think about in today's market?
I do think so. I think that, you know, There's a very successful Hollywood marketing machine that still exists, that's going to be able to, you know, force these movies into the marketplace in a way that they'll get the kind of attention that will guarantee us at least a certain level of success, even if it's disappointing for the studio. But yeah, you know, I think that you know, we're finding ourselves very deep into a sequel and franchise culture, and I think that there's just some natural burnout and fatigue that comes from complete lack of originality, you know. So if you've spent all summer watching part twos and threes and fours and fives of movies, or you know, remakes of old TV shows or whatever, you know, you sort of I do think people want to be told new stories, or they at least want to be told familiar stories in new ways. So it's encouraging to me that some of the big successes this year are coming from the sort of lower budget sphere, you know. And I also think that the crop of young filmmakers that started doing their, you know, and I'll include myself in this group of people that sort of had our first features come out around 2005, you know, so it's been almost a decade. You know, I think that we're seeing the sort of maturation process of that, you know. So David Lowery's got Ain't Them Body Saints coming out, and James has Spectacular Now, and you know, Ty West's new movie is going to premiere in Vienna, and then it's going to go to Toronto, and you know, we're just at a point where a lot of us are doing our biggest movies, you know, sort of a lot of us who've been working together and sort of and Bujalski's new movie is out now, which is doing, I think, better than any of his previous films. So it's really cool to just sort of see that you know, the period where we were sort of building our audience is sort of reaching a crescendo moment, and people are working with bigger actors, and the movies are just being seen by more people.
Mm-hmm. And with Drinking Buddies, I'm sure as a director, you couldn't have asked for a better cast. And from following the movie on Twitter and following the stars of the film, it seems like everyone really believed in this, and they all came to work. What's it like for you as a director when you have a great cast that really believes in what you're doing?
Well, that's the ticket, right? I mean, that's sort of I feel like every movie I've ever, like, really fallen in love with, that's sort of what you hear, is that, you know, everybody was on the same page and they were happy to be working together. You know, I mean, there's a lot to be said for creative, talented people doing their best work, you know? And so I felt really lucky to have those actors there and you know, especially lucky that they chose to be there, you know, that they wanted to be part of this project and that they wanted it to be good. That was a thrill. It was a thrill while we were shooting it, and it's been amazing, you know, now that the movie is starting to get out into the world, that they're still behind it and that they're still doing everything they can to try and get people to see it. But also these four actors are always really good, you know, so
right.
So there was that too, which was like really exciting to be working with people who I'm a fan of, you know, who I've seen in other people's movies and have been blown away by. So it was great.
And Joe, what I'm really impressed with from you is every time I talk to you, I always sense the passion and the excitement and the joy, and I never sense any cynicism or getting burnt out by the process. How do you keep the creative juices burning and flowing even when you're always so busy and doing so much?
Well, I think I'm always so busy because I like doing it so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to be on sets, you know. It's an addictive atmosphere to sort of, you know, be around people who are all working and excited and being creative, and so as soon as one thing's done, I can't wait to jump back into the next one. And it's also a chance to learn. You know, every movie I do, whether I'm acting in it or directing it or producing it or whatever, it's a chance to meet new people. It's a chance to explore different subjects. It's a chance to learn new things. Like, I feel like I'm just constantly in school, and I like school. There's nothing really to get burnt out by. You know, the only thing that ever like wears me down is the travel and being away from my family. You know, that's sort of the only negative aspect to it. But the creative process of starting with nothing and working with a lot of people to make a movie is so constantly rewarding that I'm always just thrilled to be some level of participant in it.
A film that you're a part of as an actor is getting a lot of positive buzz in Your Next. What was it like to be a part of that project for you?
That was amazing. I mean, that was really the first chance I had to see two, you know, good friends of mine who, you know, I kind of knew when they were like with Adam Wingard. Like, I met him when his first feature, Popsicle, was playing around, and he and I collaborated on a lot of stuff. And then I got to know Simon Barrett, and, you know, it was amazing to see these two friends of mine really rise to the occasion and you know, take on this bigger project than they had done before and really connect with an audience in such a major way. So, you know, the process of being there as an actor on set was really fun, and then, like, hearing the stories from Toronto of how great the reception to the movie was, and then having Lionsgate buy, you know, every step of the way, it's been this amazing series of events. And then, you know, the time that's passed between when it premiered and now that it's finally coming out, there's a lot of different rumors floating around about whether it would ever come out or it would go straight to DVD or who knows what was going to happen with it. But it's amazing to drive around. You know, I live in Chicago, and I got on the subway the other day to go to the airport, and there was, a, you know, three different Your Next posters around the subway, and then I'm in L.A. right now for Drinking Buddy's stuff, but everywhere I drive, I see your next billboards. I mean, it's crazy, you know? This is this is not a movie that any of us expected was going to be released on, you know, 2,100 screens all over the country, and that we could, like, go see it at multiplexes. So it's the whole thing's been really thrilling.
I know filmmakers talk a lot about a dream project or a project that they really want to get off the ground or something that's been working on for a long time. Do you have one of those dream projects that hasn't been made yet that you really, really, really want to get made?
Well, you know, I'm super fascinated by and I've read a lot about revolutionary American history. So, like, that's a period of time and subject matter that I would love to make something about at some point. Especially John Adams is somebody who I'm really into. But, you know, they just did the Paul Giamatti John Adams series. So it's probably going to be a little while before I could convince anybody to jump back into that territory. And then also, you know, I would love to make, like, a big sprawling epic about the history of beer, sort of starting from, you know, the very early origins of accidentally discovering, you know, the elements of making beer all the way through, like, you know, the sort of modern industrial age of beer making. So, you know, if somebody handed me a blank check, that might be what I would go off and do.
One more beer.
Oh, no, I'm fine. No, baby, I gotta go.
Good night, James. See you later.
And if she goes on a hike, will it offend you at all if I say no?
Absolutely not.
No way that I'm not going.
How about you? You want to go?
I guess you have to take a person at their word that they're actually into you.
Let's get weird.
I have an idea. Let's go swimming.
Why not? Let's go. I'm going to go in. Last chance. Come on.
Hey, babe, if we want to get married.
Which we do.
I would love to reopen the floor for that conversation.
Absolutely. I don't think that this is working. And I think 8 months is enough time to know whether something's going to work.
Tonight, no one's going home to their significant other because I no longer have one.
To be in our house and hanging out with us.
To our new kids.
Aww.
Big Mom, Big Dad.
The problem with heartbreak is that to you it's like an atomic bomb, and to the world it's just really cliche because in the end we all have the same experience.
Okay, that was Ron Livingston and Joe Swanberg. The movie is called Drinking Buddies, available now online or on demand. And thank you, Tony, very much for doing those interviews for us. Okay, Dean, some exciting news that you've been embroiled in this past week. You have been asked to be a juror at the – that's such an awkward word, juror.
Well, it's better to say jury president because that's what I was, actually.
Well, that's better. What was that thing? I think it was on 30 Rock. It was the Barbara Walters impression. The rural juror was the name of her. Anyway, so you were the jury president of the Massachusetts Independent Film Festival, correct?
Correct. And it's been a really wonderful thing. I should say right now I'm reporting live right here in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is a little suburb of Boston. The festival has gone really, really well, and last night was the closing night party. It's run by a fan of the show, Jason Miller, and he's got two fellow programmers named Chris D'Annunzio and Nolan Lee. And they've put together a beautiful festival at it's basically taking place at two different theaters here in one in Somerville, which is also, you know, another part of Boston, really, but it's its own city, but it's still, you know, right next to Boston, at the Somerville Theater, and then 2 days at the Brattle Theater. Now the Brattle Theater is really interesting because it's it's like a full-on repertory theater. I mean, it's been there for a really long time, and but they actually show 35mm prints as well as video, too. I took a look at their projection room, and what's interesting about their projection room is it's actually behind the screen. So they project from behind the screen. You don't get the – and that's really a fascinating aspect of it. But, again, beautiful place, and the hosts have been very, very kind. They're big fans of the show, and, I mean, Jason can actually quote things, episodes of the show to me and stuff. So that's kind of surreal. So I was the jury president, and that meant that I had to sit and watch all the movies. You know, I guess it was about 40 titles or so, including, you know, mostly shorts, but about 7 features maybe. This is one of those festivals that, you know, since it's only going on one screen at a time, it's easy, you know, if you want to buy a 3-day pass, you can see everything that it has to offer. So, and that's not the same with other festivals where there's multiple screens going on at the same time, obviously. The quality of the films has been very high. And also, even though they're all independent films, it's been a wide range of independent films. My favorite documentary is actually won Best Documentary and Best Editing. It's a 45-minute documentary. It's considered a feature here, but I would kind of consider it a short because I think anything under 50 minutes is a short. But at any rate, they considered it a feature, so it won feature documentary. It's called The Comic Book Palace. It's a great movie by Felipe George. That's the filmmaker's name, and it basically just is a snapshot of life at this comic book store called the Comic Book Palace in Haverhill, Massachusetts, which is about, I don't know, like 30 minutes outside of Boston. And it's run by this guy named Glenn O'Leary, who owns the business. And of course, he has his you know, favorite customers coming in, and it's also kind of you know, like that Kevin Smith show, you know, which I haven't seen, you know, where they're sitting around in a comic book shop. This particular film, you know, it knows to be exactly how long it should be, and in this length, it not only tells the story of the running of this business and the challenges and the benefits of running your own business, especially a business that caters to, deals with things that you love, like this guy does with comic books, also his relationships with the customers, his relationships with the regulars, which is a wide variety of types. You know, there's one guy that believes in traditional comics, you know, and doesn't like Superman being – he likes the old Superman, not the new Superman. And they – in the film, you know, the film's good because it makes no allowance. It says whether you're a comic book fan or not, we're going to show you what the life is like here, and we're also going to talk about comics, and we're not going to dumb it down for you. So, and we're not going to spend a lot of time explaining things for you. So when they get into talking about the merits of certain writers and certain artists and so forth, it gets very geeky like we do on the show about we get on the show about movies. But it's wonderful, you know, even though I don't know much about comics, I thought, wow, this is kind of an education. And it's just very, very affectionate movie. And they do get into talking about comic book movies and so forth. But the film never gets boring. The guy did it, Felipe George did it in over the space of 7 months and got, you know, 1 terabyte of material out of it, you know, and then cut it all down to a very manageable and just very entertaining length. Last night, the closing night feature was a feature that is going to hit wide. It's called COG, and it's directed by Kyle Patrick Alvarez. It's based on a story by David Sedaris, and it stars Jonathan Groff, who's very good in
what
the film.
What story by David Sedaris?
I don't know exactly. I just know that it was based on a story by
David Sedaris, but I didn't make that note. But it's basically what it's about is Jonathan Groff plays a guy. You know, at the beginning of the movie, he's kind of running away from something, and he's out into rural California. I can't even remember where it's set, but it looks like New England to me. But anyway, he goes to work in an apple orchard that's run by Dean Stockwell, who's got a nice supporting performance in it. And then he goes, you can see he's kind of running away from his past. He's running away from his family and so forth. He's just broken up with a girlfriend, or the girlfriend's actually broken up with him. But he also sort of has like an eye for guys too. It's about Jonathan Groff's character's, search for identity in the midst of not only working in this apple orchard. It's kind of set into three acts, basically. He's working in the apple orchard, then he goes to work in an apple factory where they box and crate apples and pick the best ones and so forth to put into crates.
Right.
And that's where he meets a guy played by Corey Wilson who definitely has the hots for him. So, and then the third act of it comes with Jonathan Groff kind of running away from the threat of that relationship, and actually taking up with a Christian man played by in an incredible supporting performance by Dennis O'Hare. And it's a Christian artisan who works in stone and makes clocks out of jade stone. And that's where the movie, to me, gets really, 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 really good. My fellow jurors didn't feel like it had – I thought it was beautifully shot. And they just released the trailer for it on IMDb, so you can go check it out and check it out for yourself. But I thought it was really, really well done. It was my choice for out of the nominees for best feature. It was my choice. But my fellow juror, Skip Shea, and who's an actor who's been in Shutter Island and a few other, he's been taking Woodstock, I know, and he's got a kind of a rich career as an actor and filmmaker. And also the other juror on the jury was Peter Keough, who is the former critic for the now gone Boston Phoenix, and is now freelancing for the Boston Globe. But they didn't think too much of COG, but I really dug it. I thought it was good. We also showed Musical Chairs, which, you know, we don't really have to talk about Susan Sinemon's Musical Chairs because she's been a guest on the show, and I've already reviewed it on the show, and if you want to know, I mean, I really liked the movie and everything, and it actually did very well in our awards. I saw one feature that we all know about, and I'm not sure if either one of you guys have seen this movie. It came out in April, and the programmers here asked the filmmaker, who's from Boston, if they could show it at their film festival, and they said yes. You know, after a lot of negotiation, they finally relented and said yes. And it turned. I went into this movie thinking, I'm not a fan of this guy's movies, but I came out and I think it's one of my 10 favorite movies so far this year. And it's Rob Zombie's The Lords of Salem. Have you guys seen this movie yet?
No, I was actually thinking of taking it off my Netflix queue, but now I won't.
This movie is absolutely jaw-dropping for me. I just, maybe it's because I went in with absolutely no expectations, and I really haven't been able to make it through any of Rob Zombie's movies because they're just not my type of thing. You know, Devil's Rejects and House of a Thousand Corpses, it's just not my deal, you know. But this movie was completely different, and I think what really got me in there, first of all, was just the look of the film was just absolutely stunning. Every set decoration was just mind blowing. Makeup, photography, costuming, sound, music, even just music choices, you know, his sort of source music score. And I really loved, it's got a, you know, it doesn't have as deep of a cast as Devil's Rejects does, you know, with all those tons of people in that, but it does have, of course it features his wife, Sherry Moon Zombie, who's really great in the lead. I mean, I didn't, you know, I know he uses her in every one of his movies and so forth, but I just thought she was superb in this movie. It's got an interesting supporting cast. Bruce Davison is a witch expert. Judy Geeson, the British actress, and Dee Wallace as two of three, you know, crazy old ladies that live in Sherry Moon's zombies
wow.
apartment building. And
Dee Wallace has already graduated to the crazy old lady stage of her career.
Yeah, really.
Wow.
She has. There's Michael Berryman is in it, and Sid Haig, and you know, there's a few other interesting cast members in it. But I'll tell you, if I may use the F word right now, I was fucking riveted by this movie. I mean, I did not expect this. It really, I mean, it has touches of Rosemary's Baby, touches of The Shining. It's obviously influenced by both of those movies in a heavy way. A little bit of The Exorcist as well, but used very, very well. Like these are real homages, not just straight steals. They're real homages and just beautifully done. I was stunned by it. Another horror movie is. This is and it's really easy to talk about. It's called Hazmat, and it takes place in an abandoned chemical factory where a reality show crew has gained access to, and they're doing sort of a scare tactics type show. It's called Scary Antics, and they go in there to play a prank on two unsuspecting, you know, victims who are really actresses. And basically one of the people that goes in there gets possessed by an evil hazmat suit that they put on, and they become a killer. And so it's basically, you know, like a killer in this, you know, maze-like kind of abandoned factory. And it's really funny. I don't want to oversell it. But it's really funny. It's extra fun. It's sort of like an, you know, the director. It's a female director named Lou Simon, and she's a huge horror fan. And she said she had been injured in an accident, and she was taking pain pills, and she just happened to write this. You know, before she knew it, she started writing, and she wrote this movie. And it's filmed down in Miami, actually, in your, you know, in your state, Jamie. And it's just, you know, it's just really good. And it actually has some really, really sharp performances in it, like and some big laughs, like laughs that she actually meant to be in there, because she says, you know, horror, you know, TV horror is not fun without a lot of comedy in there, so. And it wasn't too gory or anything like that, just enough gore. And I could easily see that movie. It was definitely better than anything on Sci-Fi Channel or anything, you know. So it definitely.
Well, that's not Sci-Fi Channel. That's not setting the bar very high.
No, it's not. But it's definitely better than that, and those do get some viewership. So anyway, she deserves to. Get the movie seen in whatever way she can. Maybe she can be a guest on the show, you know, when she gets released for it, because it's really fun. Shorts wise, you know, lots of good shorts. Some of them not so good, but a few really good ones. I want to mention Pega Arce's film from Iran, which actually kind of swept the awards, and it's called Silence, and it's a 15-minute story about a little kid delivering DVDs to various people around in Tehran. But also, really what it's about is in all the places that he delivers things to, there's sort of clashes between men and women. So it's really about the sort of the desperation that men feel financially there, but mostly it's about the women and how women are treated in Iran. And Pega is a fan of the show, by the way. She knew who I was when she heard. She was excited when she heard that I was on the jury, and she went through hell to get this movie made, as she does through all of her movies being made in Iran. She has to go through a major to get the movie made. She has to go through a major set of hurdles, and then to get the movie seen, she has to go through a major set of hurdles. And you know, she says in Iran, you know, they don't want anybody making movies about how they live their life, because they want to keep it all secret, and they said, don't tell the world about our problems or anything, is their motto. But anyway, silence was the most brilliant short that I saw, and such a big subject in 15 minutes. She really did an amazing job, and she's actually in the film too. The film actually won an award for her for best short, best director, best writer, and supporting actor. Another short that I really, really loved was a film from this area called Winter Hill. It was directed by Melissa Bruno, and it's also 15 minutes long. It's basically the story of the dissolution of a female friendship. Also starring non-actors, both of which won acting awards, Nicole Bushell and Brianna Buckley. And it's a 90s period piece, autobiographical. Bruno did a tremendous job of directing these actresses into very believable climbs, and just a little story, but that kind of thing that we never see in movies. You know, there were a lot of female film directors that came out with great stuff. I don't know what was going on at this festival, but almost everybody that won an award as a director was female, with the exception of Felipe George for the comic book movie. You know, we had Susan Seidelman won for Musical Chairs, Pega Arzi for Silence, and Melissa Bruno for Winter Hill, and also Lou Simon for Hazmat. So, I saw a lot of other great stuff, films like Lapse. You know, I got to meet the director. This was very interesting, by the way. This will be the last one that I talk about. And then I'll tell you, where you can go and take a look at some of the stuff online. But I saw there was a film from New York called Lapse, and it's by Anthony Salerno, and it's produced by a guy named Bill Timoney. These guys, a very good movie. If I was going to be perfectly honest, it's maybe about 8 minutes too long, but it's about a guy kind of spiraling down into like rock bottom and a substance abuse problem, and the things that led to the substance abuse problem and the things that lead him out of it. It's very well edited and well shot. It's got a nice lead performance in it too. What's interesting about the two guys who made this movie is that they actually met as producers and as voice talent doing anime work. The director is actually one of the leading producers of anime. And what I mean by that is anime dubbing. So the producer was telling me stories about working on some really big anime titles, like, the dubbing of Legend of the Overfiend and Akira and stuff like that. So he has major and here's another thing that's interesting about Bill Timoney too. he's currently working. He's old friends with Bryan Cranston, and he's in town in Boston working on he's the producer of a new play with Bryan Cranston as Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Michael McKean is also in it as J. Edgar Hoover. Anybody who's interested in this, any filmmaker out there who's interested in submitting to this film festival, which you should, they're very fair, it's, their website is massiff.org. Again, I have to thank, you know, Jason Miller and Nolan Lee and Kristen Nunzio, who were incredible hosts, and I've made a ton of great friends up here, and as I said, I might be moving up here. That's how much I love it. And by the way, all three of those guys, they're all filmmakers, so what's very, what's even more, I don't know, exciting for me is maybe if I get up here, maybe I'll start making films.
That'd be good. All right.
Yeah.
Dean's life changed this weekend in Boston.
I'd like to invite you to the state dinner next week.
I'm going to be there, Miss Reagan.
No. Not as a butler, Cecil. I'm inviting you as a guest.
But the president prefers for me to serve in person.
Don't you worry about Ronnie. I'll take care of that.
The butler seems designed from you know, sketch one at the beginning of the conception of it to be Oscar bait material. Does it play like that?
Oh, it is. You know, I won't lie to you. You watch the movie. I mean, I think Forest Whitaker's performance is very good. And I think the first half of the movie is very interesting. And the second half does get into Forrest Gump territory. It does.
Mean, really?
Because of the historical events. I think that whatever Robert Zemeckis did with Forrest Gump, he did pave the way for, oh, we have to include this, this, and this.
Yeah,
it's
the greatest.
It's an interesting
America's
movie. Yeah, it is. No, it is like that. I
and
think
not the America that did you know, Sister Golden Hair.
No, you know, you're right. What did throw me off about the butler was nothing in the butler. It was our very good friend Matthew Wilder liked the butler as much as he did. I saw his Facebook post this afternoon, and I was dumbfounded. He really liked it. This is Lee Daniels' most conventional film, and he's not conventional. I mean, to watch The Paperboy, that alone, there's nothing in it. You would never know the guy who directed The Paperboy did The Butler. Throw that all out the window. You would never know the guy who directed Precious, with the exception of Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
The butler is so conventional, though. It's
so
baity. You know, it's so awesome. It just reeks. I mean, and you're watching Oprah in this. You're just like, oh, my God, this is the Oprah. This is Oprah's moment. This is where if she doesn't win the Oscar, I mean, she is going to tackle Jennifer Lawrence. During this campaign, she's for American Hustle. That is, there's going to be a scene at Spago. She's going to, you know, punch her in the gut. And you cannot have this. This is my moment. But I have to hand it to Oprah. She orchestrated this opening weekend beautifully with all the controversy.
I mean, Harvey Weinstein gave it. Got tens of millions of dollars of free publicity just from the title argument alone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it you know, Lee Daniels got on it. I mean, Danny Strong had written it, and of course he wrote Game Change and Election Recount. So it's of a similar ilk. It's kind of tackling America and politics but on human terms. And then Lee Daniels came on it, and Lee Daniels worked with Danny Strong for about 3 years before they were actually able to make it. So it's been a long gestating project.
Right. That's a good point about Danny. You know, about you bring him. I like Game Change. I like Recount.
because I learned things I didn't know about that period, recent, you know, if we want to, recent history, that I wouldn't have known. There is this, if you want to, you know, we want to joke about all the people playing the presidents and the first ladies and everything. John Cusack's Nixon, while I don't want to, there is a scene where John Cusack, where he's Vice President Nixon, goes into the kitchen, and it's Forrest Whitaker, Lenny Kravitz, and Cuba Gooding Jr. And Cuba Gooding Jr. And Lenny Kravitz aren't, I mean, the performances of those three actors alone is incredible. They're wonderful performances. I don't want to take away from that. I think that Forrest Whitaker does give an incredible performance, and I think Lenny Kravitz and Cuba Gooding Jr.
By the way, when is Forrest Whitaker ever bad in a movie? Like,
that's a great point. That's a great point, Dean. But he's very good.
Yeah.
But there is a scene, and I don't know if this ever happened. Where Vice President Nixon walks in with these buttons, Nixon for president. You don't want to elect that Kennedy for president, that rich boy. You want to elect me. I will do things for your people. I trying to hold it in. I didn't want to burst out laughing, but I did. But it's full theater. You know, and I'm just like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening. I just burst out laughing.
You know what?
Is it a good performance, though?
Oh, it's a great performance.
It does show that you don't have to be factual to be truthful.
No, that's true.
And that's a great point. I mean, Nixon was at a point in his political career where that envy, that Kennedy envy, was reaching a fever pitch, you know.
Oh, of course. It's funny, though. I mean, it's all the paranoia, it's all the things that we know about Nixon that make it such an interesting performance watching Cusack of all people and watching, you know, the funny thing I want to say though is that, you know, all the big things that was made about Jane Fonda playing Nancy Reagan, she's not in it though. She's really very briefly in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hear that Alan Rickman's Reagan is a very kind of, it's a subdued performance.
Oh, very subdued.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to say this about the movie, though.
Did they just show Reagan falling asleep at behind?
Oh, no. It is a very complimentary performance. I have to say this, though. They obviously, using the release date, they were obviously trying to copy The Help and everything. This is one of those movies, whether they want to admit it or not, this is one of those movies where they want white people to feel good about what they did for African Americans, and that's where the film just crashes into the barricade. It doesn't work, and it's so obvious, I think, at times. If I was an African American, I would be kind of insulted about this film. More so than The Help, even. I mean, The Help is basically Emma Stone's save black people. I mean, if you really want to get down to it, it was Emma Stone's character save the, you know, and it is kind of like that in a way. It just seems like there's a lot of white liberal guilt associated with this movie.
Which is so odd since it comes from Lee Daniels. But
I know, that's what I really feel bad, you know, saying that, but I get that impression, though.
Well, here's what A.O. Scott said about it. It is important to emphasize that The Butler, unlike almost every other movie about race in America, is not primarily about the moral awakening of white people, nor does it neatly divide whites into snarling bigots and paragons of tolerance. There are certainly instances of raw prejudice and of sincere decency, but the presidents are complex and contradictory creatures. Lyndon B. Johnson spews racial slurs even as he prepares to sign the most sweeping civil rights legislation since Lincoln. Ronald Reagan treats the black White House staff more fairly than any of his predecessors. His wife Nancy invites Cecil to a state dinner but fails to grasp the moral enormity of South African apartheid. They all appreciate Cecil's service without ever quite seeing him fully as a person. The room should feel empty when you're in it, he is told by his supervisors, and he becomes adept at disappearing in plain sight. So, it feels like A.O. Scott saying that it doesn't really fall on an appeasement of white guilt. But I mean, I
want to agree with him. I really want to agree with him. But there are times you can't help but feel it's not the fault of the filmmakers. You just can't help but feel because of the way they changed the release date and everything. They want to copy the help, and I think you know, Scott's review is right. But it just there is at times though, watching the movie, you can't help but feel. I don't think it's a bad movie. I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's an interesting movie.
Well, let me just say something about this notion that they're trying to copy the help. And I was talking about this with Jason today. And I think what's happening now is that, you know how we now have seen the summer movie season actually move up into spring a little bit? Like, it's in,
mm-hmm.
it kind of starts in late April now, not in June anymore. I think what we're seeing now is in a similar sort of tectonic shift in release strategies. Is I think what we're going to start seeing from now on is the fall movie season, the award season, actually kind of moving into the middle of August now.
Yeah,
and
I think you're absolutely right. That's a good point.
I think there's just some kind of just generally agreed on shift now that this is going to happen. And I guarantee it's going to happen again next year because didn't The Butler do really well this weekend? I mean, what, it hit like 25 or 30 million, right?
No, The Butler did, I think, like almost 30 million, but it's...
That's pretty damn good for a movie like that.
Damn good? I mean, I wish I had that kind of money.
It only cost $25 million to make.
So we need to talk about the other movies that opened this weekend, though.
What it has now is a lot of time and a lot of word of mouth, and so it's going to circulate more and more, and the buzz is going to get bigger on it, and more people are going to go see it. So it's got a lot of space between now and
Oscar
season, which can be a blessing and a curse, because at what time during the Oscar nomination period does it fall out of the conversation? Did it peak too early?
I personally think, not having seen the movie, you know, but I personally think that you're definitely going to see Oprah Winfrey get a nomination, and if not that, then if she isn't nominated, it's going to be a big, big deal.
Shit out of whoever gets the nomination if she doesn't. She's gonna go. She's gonna crack those people.
She's not really known for starting fights, but
I think for this one she is.
But at any rate, I think that's where it's Oscar hopes, you know, end and begin. I think.
I agree. Yeah. But we have to talk about the last weekend, though, and Dean, you were the first one to alert me to this movie. We had two really awesome movies open last weekend, and it's rare that you have two movies, let alone one movie that's really awesome open in the weekend. But we had The Spectacular Now and Elysium open in the same weekend. Two really awesome movies.
I mean, so you're a pro Elysium because it's gotten a lot of mixed reviews. I mean, there's been a lot of people who have been saying that it's kind of a retread of this nine, and you can actually.
But let me ask you this: is it a bad thing when in the 4 years between those two movies, not much of substance has come out? If this is the guy who's going to do it. Then here's the thing.
I like my filmmakers to try and hold back on remaking their movies at least for a little while.
But he's not remaking his movies. I have to say that I was very skeptical going into this movie. The first movie is obviously a metaphor for apartheid. This one is a movie about all of us right now. This is about the 1% versus the 99%. And it's not even that. It goes a little bit deeper, I think. And it's got great performances.
It's basically about a guy trying to escape a dystopian society, and then, you know.
kind of. You know what the movie reminded me of? You know, a lot of people, you know, the first thing that I thought of watching the movie was Soylent Green. If a movie reminds me of Soylent Green,
That's a great thing. There's not many movies do.
Chloe Green
is one of the great. Chloe Green is one of the great dystopian movies ever made.
I did see one new movie this past week. I saw Jobs. Did you see Jobs?
I saw Jobs. What did you think of it?
I'd love to say that it blows. Or if it was good, I would have said, give it a hand. But
it's just sort of, you're watching it and you're just like, it's just like run of the mill. I mean.
Well, it's odd. What I thought was missing mainly from the movie was a director that knew what he felt about Steve Jobs.
Exactly.
I think the movie's to be commended. I mean, it does show that Steve Jobs is more than a bit of a complete louse as a human being.
Right.
You know, it doesn't paint a rosy picture of him. But what
not at all.
It spends so much effort showing that he is like a borderline Asperger's kind of no human contact, no civility kind of guy, a guy that abandoned his pregnant girlfriend and refused to see his daughter throughout her life, and it builds so much attention to that aspect of him, which is appreciated as a moviegoer. It makes it a more complex character, but then it cuts like 6 years later. All of a sudden, he's with his daughter. That he abandoned, and everything's rosy, and you're like, no, where was the part where he grew and he changed?
Yeah,
like, you know, the dramatic part.
You're absolutely right. That's
the
big problem.
Total cheat.
That sounds like a big mistake. huge mistake.
And I think that
you're
Ashton Kutcher,
right.
You know, I like Ashton Kutcher. I liked him a lot in that movie Spread. It's not a great movie, but and I like him a lot in No Strings Attached. I've appreciated him more in recent years. I think he's fine in the movie. I think that it's the kind of performance that people can easily make fun of because Steve Jobs, the way he portrays him, is one of those geeks, those awkward, antisocial geeks that borderline on caricature. There are people out there that exist that are exactly like that. And so that didn't bother me so much. The guy, the cast member that has always annoyed me in previous movies, this Josh Gad guy.
Wozniak, yeah.
Yeah. I thought he was, in performance-wise, I thought he was the high point of the movie. He has the movie's best scene, where he goes in and he tells Ashton Kutcher, you know, what are you doing, man? And you're abandoning everything. And it's a very emotional scene and very beautifully underplayed. That's the performance of the movie for me.
I'm leaving, Steve.
Okay.
No, Steve. I'm leaving Apple. For good. Actually, I already did. I thought I should come back and tell you first.
Why?
We both knew this was coming for some time. I don't even remember the last time we talked.
What do you want from me then?
Not everyone has an agenda, Steve.
Right.
You know, I can still remember when we were just kids. Back in your dad's garage. No, he just wanted to create cool toys for people like us. You remember that?
Yeah.
No, it's not about people anymore for you. No, it's about the product. Worst of all, it's about yourself. You're the beginning and end of your own world, Steve.
You know, it felt very Hallmarky. It felt really TV movie of the week, and I hate to say that, but it's because they didn't pay attention to that those changes,
right.
The growth of
the character. No, I agree, because I think the acting in the movie is fine. I don't have a problem with Kutcher. I think it's great. It helps that he is such a tech lover and everything. He knows his stuff about business and technology and everything.
And I thought that helped him. But yes, you were absolutely right. All of a sudden, we cut to this where he is living with his daughter and he's remarried or what, and you're just like, what is, where did this come from?
Yeah.
If you don't know Steve Jobs' story, you're...
If there was like a last act of his life where he underwent an extreme amount of growth, where he got into, I don't know, I think I've read like Buddhism and all kinds of stuff, and he grew as a person. We're not privy to that.
Why would they leave that out? That's weird. It's a weird movie. It's a thoughtless movie in essence. It's very careless, Dean. Because it's not based on the Walter Isaacson biography that is going to be a movie soon, on the Aaron Sorkin movie, I guess, is what that's based on. But it does seem like it's an odd movie. It does seem like you really do want to say it's too soon for this movie. You really want to say it the way the final product is just like, guys, this is, you're missing the point almost. I mean,
also it's kind of curious. If all you know about Steve Jobs is what you see in this movie, then you're thinking to yourself, why is he known as such a massive innovator? Because essentially movie, he's riding on the coattails of other people's works and ideas.
End of the movie? Dermot Mulroney has become a great actor. And all these, you know, in the last couple of years, Dermot Mulroney has just become this awesome.
Yeah, he's good. He's strong.
You know, but that's what you get out of the movie. I'm like, watch him. I'm like, yeah, he's good in this, New Girl, Stoker. You know, I can go on and on, but he's really in the gray. He's really matured into this awesome actor.
The other thing about the movie is, I just had it in my mind. The thing that makes it an ideal subject for Aaron Sorkin, since he's writing his own job script, like you said, is that essentially – Jobs, this movie is the exact same movie as The Social Network, because it's about a completely antisocial asshole that was an innovator in new technology, and that new technology got threatened. People were going to take it away from him, take away his own company from him, and the turmoil that that cost him. But
so it's that story again.
The difference,
and that doesn't come across in this one that well.
Plot-wise, it does. But insight-wise, it doesn't, because it doesn't have a strong director like a David Fincher to give it any insight. This guy doesn't know who his subject is. That's the problem.
That's a good point. These are all good points.
Mm. Okay.
All right. Oh, I did see one other thing that's interesting that would interest you guys. I watched a documentary last night. It's documentary Harry Dean Stanton, partly fiction. It's a feature documentary about Harry Dean Stanton. it's very strangely done. It follows him essentially for an hour and 20 minutes, and it's shot so beautifully. It's almost hypnotic the way it's played out, and it's not played out like a typical documentary, but you do really get a sense of Harry Dean Stanton, who is this old warrior, doesn't really question anything because he thinks, you know, life just happens and we don't have answers to anything, and he doesn't say much in the documentary either, because he doesn't say much in his real life. I mean, you know, one of his friends says he doesn't say much, but whatever he does say means something. What he does about six or seven times during the movie is he sings.
He must sing.
He sits in front of the camera with a guitarist and he sings, and he has the most sublime, gorgeous singing voice.
I've been doing this for 50 fucking years, being photographed, doing movies. After a while, I get out tired of it.
Everybody talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying. The echoes on my mind. People stop and staring, I can't see their faces. Only shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. going with the climate suits my clothes.
He's been in how many, 170 films or something?
Over 200.
Over 200.
250 maybe. I've lost count a long time ago.
How would you describe yourself?
There's nothing. There's no self.
How would you like to be remembered?
Doesn't matter.
He's also one of those actors who knows that his face is a story, and he doesn't have to. He just has to be in that thing, you know, and his face is the story. You know, you read all kinds of things. And
God, he was so much a part of my life that when I was still working at the Troubadour, he would get up and sing with me every now and then. He loved to sing Mexican songs. And Speak of the Devil.
The big stars of mine. My love behind.
And there's interesting parts. There's maybe like 30-35% of stuff about his movies in there. But it's mm-hmm. just enough to whet your appetite and make you want more. But not overkill. Like there's a section in there where he's sitting on his couch with David Lynch and they're talking back and forth. And then they interview Wim Wenders and Sam Shepard quite a lot about Harry. So it's a documentary that people are going to be talking a new way about Harry Dean Stanton. And I'm glad.
Does it make it clear how long he's been in movies? I mean, the earliest movie I remember seeing him in was 1959's Porkchop Hill. Which has a crazy huge cast, you know.
It makes it clear he's done over 200 movies. He's been doing it 50, 60 years. All the kind of wealth of experiences that he's had, and he's known as one of the, you know, and there's something about him too, and you could just look at his work in the Lynch movies, some of which he only has one scene in, but there's such an enormous amount of inner life. So he will make his one scene just so incredibly emotional and memorable because he's playing on some kind of deep pain that he has from his background. And you can see that he has that, even though he won't talk about it. He says, no, I don't want to talk about my childhood and all that kind of stuff. But you can tell that's the well he continues to draw from. Our last guest tonight, there's a great new movie out called What Maisie Knew. It's told entirely from the point of view of a young girl whose parents are going through a divorce and the confusion that sets in the tow. It's from filmmaker Scott McGehee and David Siegel. Stars Julianne Moore, Steve Coogan, and Alexander Skarsgård. It's now available on Blu-ray and on demand. It's a pleasure speaking to. It is a good movie. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Good cast. Julianne Moore
and the lead girl. We should mention.
Incredible.
I don't know if you have her name, but in front of you, I don't. But she is incredible. Like one of the best
Onata April. Yeah,
she's
a massive find, and we talk about her in this interview. So here's Scott and David to tell us all about it.
You know, that's why the judge and the experts, they saw that.
No,
they saw you.
No.
Then why are they not giving you sole custody?
Because you've got a female judge, that's why.
I'm not taking her.
I'm not taking her. They gave her to me.
My father's here.
Listen, why don't you and me go and get ourselves a nice double espresso?
With Mommy?
No, it's just you and me this time.
A nice room with Daddy.
Margo was there.
Margo? You mean our Margo? Margo was at our house?
Your daddy's sad when you're not here. It's nice for him to have someone around to cheer him up.
I thought that Maisie's mother was supposed to be doing pickup today.
She sent me to get her daughter.
Who are you?
Sort of like Maisie's stepfather.
The scar is a fleck on my porcelain skin.
Did you really get married?
You don't have to call him daddy or anything.
Maisie has something she'd like to share with the class.
This is my new stepfather.
Hi.
My father married my nanny, so Court made my mommy get married too.
You know, you don't get a bonus for making her fall in love with you.
Are you and Daddy still married?
I may have to go back to England. You understand?
So what are you doing with my daughter?
Looking after her while you're on tour.
Things have been a little rough with her mother gone.
You really like him, don't you?
I love him.
There's nothing to say.
I guess the first thing that really strikes me about the film is the point of view of it, which is told entirely through the eyes of this little girl, and it feels very authentic. I would imagine that was one of the main selling points of the project for you guys as well.
Yes, in fact, it was. That and Julianne Moore, I think, were the two selling points for us. But we were excited about both projects.
And what was the process for you guys immersing yourself in that particular point of view?
We approached it just, sort of like you would approach all the other questions related to, like, you know, sort of how you put a movie together, and especially in terms of shooting it, you know, sort of where the camera is and how high the camera is and what comes in and out of frame and what characters see and don't see. You just sort of have the idea, you know, it kind of distills everything down when you're restricting that to the kind of heavy bias of one particular character. And then when you have that, when that character is 3 feet tall, you know, it reduces it again. In a weird way, it gives you a sort of program that allows you to hang a lot of other things off of.
Another way to come at that question is, you know, what we did to kind of remind ourselves what it's like to be six. And that was, a problem. We spent a fair amount of time visiting schools, in kind of preparation, both for shooting the school scenes and just to kind of, you know, be around some six-year-olds. We have some friends who are teachers, and we, you know, just kind of got in touch with a bunch of schools in New York City that allowed us to come and visit and spend time in their classrooms and get to know their kids a little bit. And then I guess the casting process was another real education about six-year-olds. We met a ton of little girls, each one different from the last, like little snowflakes. But, it took us quite a while to finally find Onata. But in that process, we really did kind of learn a lot about kids that age, which was an interesting education.
Yeah, and Onata, it gives such a soulful performance. I mean, you could tell she's 100% present.
Yeah, it was just an extraordinary thing working with her. Her ability to just be like utterly and completely natural in front of the camera, to just sort of block out, you know, the world that is outside of that set, outside of that moment, and to just sort of be the thing that she was pretending to be was really remarkable.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was saying that we learned a lot about kids that age in the casting process. Like, one of the things we learned, or kind of thought we learned early on, is that there is something kind of special about kids that age. Like, you know, like a lot of kids who are, you know, coming into audition at 6 years old, have a kind of naturalness, and they're not self-conscious in a way that kids just a little bit older start getting self-conscious and more self-aware, and, you know, kind of trying to do the right thing. Whereas, you know, six-year-olds, we found, tended to really just kind of be themselves. But then, you know, in the world of six-year-olds who are kind of like that anyway, we found Onata, who is sort of, you know, that extra bit more that way, and you know, we've stayed in touch with her. Of course, we're very friendly with her mom, and see Onata quite a bit still. And she's a year and a half older now than when we shot, and I have to say she's still that way. She's still just really a natural, kind of at ease in her own skin kind of kid who is just a pleasure to be around.
I think you're so right, and you know, you mentioned the lack of self-consciousness of children, and I mean, by definition, I mean they kind of live and exist in the moment, which is absolutely something that all actors aspire to, and I'm sure that actors can learn and feed off from when they're acting across from a child of that age. But did you find that it had that same effect for you guys as directors, forcing you to exist in the moment that you were directing?
That's an interesting question. No one's ever asked us that. I guess I would say yes, just in the sense that, you know, the kind of level of concentration that was required to sort of reach the same, I don't know, the same level of concentration. I guess I've never thought about that before. That's an interesting question.
I mean, we were all kind of inspired by what we were watching in Onanta every day. The actors would comment on it, really regularly, after doing a scene with her, that was special. They'd pick us aside and say, like, wow. And Alexander said exactly what you were saying to us after shooting the scene. There was quite a long extended take we did with he and Onanta in the recording studio when they're coloring together. And, he sort of called us aside afterwards and was like, that was amazing. Like, that, I'll work my whole life to do a take that's that, honest and, from beginning to end. Like, there wasn't a false note. But I guess as directors, our job isn't being kind of super aware of what's going on and kind of paying attention to the things you're not expecting and, kind of, and being open to the surprises. I mean, all actors even actors who aren't sick, give us a lot of that every day. That's kind of one of the exciting things about being on set.
I'm sure that a big part of establishing this child's point of view, as we've been discussing, a large part of that is also credit to the collaboration you have with your cinematographer, which you've worked with Giles for several films now. And I speak with him tomorrow, so tell me anything you can about your collaboration with him.
I could tell you to turn up your microphone because he mumbles. and he has a British accent. So sometimes it just sounds like, Yeah. we love Giles so much. I mean, he's become, as you can imagine, a good friend as well as, a collaborator. But we shot more of this movie handheld than we have previous movies with Giles. And Giles had just come off of actually shooting Midnight's Children with Deepa Mehta, and almost that entire film was shot on his shoulder. And so we talked about, trying to, the handheld work needing to be able to really sit within, a movie that was, that felt, more deliberately framed than, something that had a kind of documentary feel. But the reason why we were going with a lot of handheld work was, one, because Onanta was so small, but also to kind of loosen it up and make it feel as natural as possible. We also talked with Giles about things that we talked with the other Keys about, Kelly McGee, who we've also made many movies with, Scott's sister, our production designer, and Stacey Batat, the costumer, who this is the second film that we've worked on with her. Talked a lot about that everything really needing to be, the whole mise-en-scène of the movie sort of collaborating to convey this sense of a point of view, that the light and the color and the world, the costuming, the world of the movie is the world of Maisie. And, it's not a movie that should feel childlike. It should just feel like it comes somehow in a sense of feeling from a child's point of view.
And the other cast members, particularly Julianne Moore and Steve Coogan. I mean, these on paper, it seems like they're going against type. These aren't the roles that they're normally cast for. I mean, Julianne Moore has proven that she can do anything, but you don't necessarily think rock star when you look at Julianne Moore. And Mr. Coogan's role here, he infuses it with a certain amount of humor, but it's more dramatic than we're accustomed to seeing him play. Was that an appeal, kind of casting against type?
Well, we we, you know, Steve Coogan was the first guy that we thought of for the role, you know, and you know, there was, took a little convincing with producers and whatnot because, it, you know, he doesn't really, you know, mean much, you know, in the United States in terms of financing. At least that's what we're told. But we're such huge fans of his, and we wanted him to bring a little bit of his humor to a role that was essentially dramatic, and we'd seen his dramatic work, and we knew, you know, he's a dramatically trained actor, that he could pull it off, you know, from that side of it. So in that sense, I guess we were casting against type, but like wanting a little bit of, you know, the other type to creep in. I mean, Julianne's played a lot of roles where she's been kind of fierce. I don't think she's ever been quite so, you know, stubbornly unlikable for as much of the movie as she is. And but you know, we've seen Julianne be tough in a way that we knew she'd be able to pull that off.
The rock star part of it, though, like, I mean, she said, you know, and she said to us in our first meeting, she told us she couldn't sing, but she also told us that was the part of the role that most attracted her was, you know, trying to do that thing that she'd never done, and you know, that's, she was really afraid of it, kind of, but I think that's kind of, you know, a piece of her character as an actress, that she's really attracted to things that scare her a little bit, I think.
Absolutely. You know, and you mentioned that that she's playing someone that does a lot of unlikable things. But this is another point that really struck me about the piece, is that there are no villains in the movie, and it comes from a point of understanding that, you know, we all have stumbling blocks and problems and issues in our own lives, and so it doesn't villainize it. It doesn't take the easy way out. That was very nice, I thought.
Thank you very much. That was something we all worked hard to kind of round those characters out so that it wasn't, you know, black and white, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the source material. I mean, this is based on a screenplay, but the screenplay is actually based on a Henry James book from something like 1896. It's not a kind of piece of material that you would expect to come from Henry James.
Yes.
we hadn't read the book before we got involved with the movie, so our kind of introduction to it was the screenplay. But we were both really surprised when we read the James and saw how much of the material that we, you know, kind of thought of as being super, you know, kind of modern, you know, the, not just the custody battle part of it, but also, you know, the kind of, you know, sexual escapades amongst the adults, and, you know, it was all right there in James. We had read that the custody battle part of it was a real, you know, unusual anomaly, that he heard about, you know, joint custody situation at a dinner party in London when he was, you know, kind of living there, and he thought it was such an absurd and crazy idea that became, you know, the kind of launching place for his little novel. It was a kind of satire of, you know, selfish adults in a situation like that. But, you know, except for that context being really different, you know, that joint custody is super common to us now, the rest of it is remarkably intact.
And in terms of shooting the film, I'm not sure how long you had to shoot it, but one of the great qualities for me in any film that deals with family is making it feel like these are authentic relationships that lived before the camera started rolling. But I'm sure you guys didn't have the luxury of spending much time getting acquainted with one another before shooting, did you?
No, it doesn't go that way usually, unfortunately. I mean, I think we had less rehearsal on this movie than we have had on anything we've ever done. And I mean, to some degree, it was because, you know, the Julianne Moore didn't start working until we were already halfway through the schedule, and Joanna Vanderham didn't come over until we were about from England because of her schedule on something else in Scotland. She wasn't here until, I think, we were 2 weeks into shooting. So we had Alexander and Onata together for a little bit,
but they were a pair who weren't supposed to know each other. It's never quite ideal, is it?
Hmm. And so tell me, you played at this film at various festivals, correct?
We have, yeah. We've traveled quite a bit with it at this point.
So when you do unveil your movie to an audience, you know, say the first time or any festival audience, what is that experience like, and what do you learn about your movie when you experience it through their eyes?
You know, I think the thing that I've learned more than anything after showing it around so much and seeing and doing a lot of Q&As for the film, I guess I'm not sure learning is exactly the right thing, but the thing that's been surprising and kind of gratifying about watching the movie play with audiences is how much people identify with it personally and in their own way, right? So people have, you know, sort of idiosyncratic responses to the film, but in very kind of personally felt ways. A lot of times that's because someone's been affected by divorce in a strong way, one way or another. But a lot of times just because people really get, like, people really, I think, identify with the feeling of childhood. And we always talked about, like, you know, we were trying to make a movie that was about an experience more than it was about trying to tell, like, in the way you would normally tell the plot points of a particular story.
I wanted to ask you about co-directing. How does that work?
We often answer that question by describing how we came into doing it, which is, you know, neither of us went to film school, and we just, you know, we're friends, and we decided to try and make some short films without any training, really. And so in doing that, we just sort of did it together, kind of did what was necessary and kind of, you know, talked to everybody together, planned it all together. And that, you know, kind of background of kind of just doing it together ourselves is, you know, that kind of was the foundation of how we, you know, continue to work. We don't divide it up. So, you know, I'd say the fact that we're friends and the fact that we trust each other, and then, you know, a lot of planning and, you know, kind of most of the disagreement phase, I think, happens long before we ever, you know, get to set. So mm-hmm. Hopefully by the time we're on set, and certainly through the editing process, we're really in sync with each other. And it's just, you know, Tilda Swinton once described us as two bodies with one brain. And that's sort of the ideal we're reaching for. It's just like that we both would always answer the, you know, any question pretty much the same way, and we're just in twice as many places to answer questions when, you know, when the stuff gets going.
Yes, I know you.
No, Susanna, you don't know anyone. You don't know anyone except yourself.
Shut
you breathe pain wherever
shut
you go.
Up.
That's your real
shut
talent.
Shut up, shut up.
Hey, do you know that's why the judge and the expert, they saw that.
No,
they saw you.
No.
Then why are they not giving you sole custody?
Because you got a female judge, and that's why.
If that's what you want to tell yourself, then fine. If you want to tell your deluded
don't
self.
Don't take her, man.
I'm not taking her. They gave her to me.
Okay, that was Scott McGeehee and David Siegel. The movie What Maisie Knew is available now on demand and on Blu-ray as well, so pick it up. It's highly recommended. Upcoming shows, just to make a programming note, on Wednesday night we have a 40th anniversary tribute to Scarecrow with Jerry Schatzberg, the director of it, and the screenwriter Gary Michael White. And next Sunday we have, when we all come back, we have director Rennie Harlan joins us to talk about his new movie. And then next Wednesday we have director John Badham coming on to talk about a new book. And then we'll come back the following Sunday to do something. And then our 2-week Art of Cinematography series starts up again. So just to run down a list of some of the cinematographers, there's close to 20. So it's going to be nonstop shows this 2 weeks. Bruno Del Manel, who shot Amelie and Dark Shadows and Inside Llewyn Davis.
Wow.
Darius Wolski, who shot Crimson Tide and Prometheus and The Counselor, the new Ridley Scott movie. And I think he's about to shoot. He's actually talking to us from the set of Exodus because he's shooting that for Ridley Scott next. Stephen Chomsky, who shot Ed Wood and Edward Scissorhands and Batman Returns.
Oh, my God.
Ed Wood, boy, that's some of the best cinematography ever, if you ask me.
Yeah. Rachel Morrison, who just shot Fruitvale Station, Thomas Del Ruth, The Breakfast Club, Stand By Me, Benoit Delhomme, who shot The Proposition and The Merchant of Venice and Lawless, Stephen Poster, who did all the Richard Kelly movies. And,
Wow.
I told him, Jerry, that you're a major fan of Southland Tales, and he loves you for it.
I love him, so.
Peter Menzies Jr., who's about to shoot Expendables 3, and he also shot Die Hard with a Vengeance and A Time to Kill. The cinematographer for the Polish brothers? Yeah, Twin Falls, Idaho, and North Fork, and the astronaut.
Oh yeah, the Polish. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just on and on and on and on. We got a lot of them coming up. So that'll start September 2nd. You can go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net/art of cinematography, for all the details. Also visit our new blog, moviegeeksunited.net/blog, for the latest news, film reviews, and advanced clips of some of the special shows and interviews we're going to be putting up here soon. All right. So, Jerry, you had a guess as to what the closing mystery score would be.
I want to say Exorcist 2, but I mean, I have a guess.
Okay.
Is it Psycho 2?
Oh, that would be interesting. That would be Jerry Goldsmith's Psycho 2. That's a good guess. it's actually Exorcist 2. It's a Neo Morricone.
I won something finally.
Yeah, you finally got something right on the Name That Film Score show.
I know, really. Wow.
Wasn't the right show.
That's funny.
All right, guys. So we'll be back next Sunday.
All right. Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.